across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. Strike action at the top of the show today. So Patrick Mulholland, he's from the health union NIPSA. He's talking about making the government squeal. And he's saying the strikes need to hurt. Hurt who? How do strikes not hurt patients and people sitting on waiting lists? And it's not just the health workers, the teachers now. They want to go on strike. We'll hear from one of their unions this morning. And the whole yin and yang of if we pay out more money, very valid argument in terms of people getting the same pay as across the water. Do we revenue raise the same? Our tuition fees are half here than they are in England, for example. Water rates and the debate around that. What do we do? Those stories, potholes, loads of stories on the Nolan Show this morning. I'm slightly hyper, so I need to do what I've been told to do, which is breathe. Hope you enjoy the show. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. The Nolan Show revealed yesterday morning to you that Northern Ireland water staff were being balloted for strike action. Now, unions representing the majority of teachers here are holding a vote due, they say, to the lack of a satisfactory pay offer for 24-25. We hear in the news this morning that the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, is meeting the health unions today. NIPSA is one of them. NIPSA is using language this morning of militant strikes designed to hurt.
There's a deep sense of betrayal, a deep sense of frustration, and I think we have to expect that to express itself through industrial action that will be hard-hitting and will be designed to hurt.
Well, Patrick Mulholland, the man who said that, you've just heard his voice from NIPSA, with us today. Morning to you, Patrick.
Good morning, Stephen.
Designed to hurt who? Cancer patients? People on waiting lists?
No, NIPSA's industrial action, I think, this time, Stephen, will be targeted very much at vanity projects, waste in the health service, and profiteering. We will try and work up an agenda of industrial action that will be aimed at getting the message across to government, getting the message across to the Northern Ireland Assembly that this situation is not acceptable. What we will do is we will put mitigations in place to ensure that patients feel minimal effect. But within the health service...
Well, you've talked about militant action. What's militant?
Within the health service, Stephen, there are ways of targeting industrial action that will make government squeal. And that's what we will be doing. So if the health service is talking about bringing in new computer projects that are quite often vanity projects, we will not be assisting them in that process. If there are...
Sorry, hold on a second. Just before you...
Sorry, go on ahead, Stephen.
No, you finish. Go ahead.
No, it's okay.
If you describe a new computer system, in other words, how patient records are shared between medical staff, how information in a timely manner can get from one medical person to another about a patient that's sitting there. And you're describing that as a vanity project. And meanwhile, I've sat on this programme listening to patients telling me that the fact that their medical records cannot be shared has led to them having to wait longer for treatment. How is that a vanity project?
You're picking a very specific area and using that as an example, but it's not the example I give. What I'm talking about here, Stephen, are things like projects that are, you know, engaging huge amounts of money that's pouring out into the pockets of consultants. I don't mean hospital consultants. I mean all these consultants that are brought in from all over the country, pay huge amounts of money. Nobody can see any tangible results coming from that sort of work. And in fact, it is diverting resources from the front line, which is what we will now protect with our industrial action. Here is where we are today, Stephen. We're in Groundhog Day. We thought these discussions were over. We thought this treatment of the health service staff was over. We thought that the Assembly was going to act responsibly and it was going to at least meet the party arrangements that are in place. And the Assembly gave a commitment, by the way, and the political parties gave a commitment that they were going to match party. You'll remember this yourself last year, that commitment was given. And straight away, we're back into this dark place again. where the health service workers are coming under pressure. It's not acceptable. It's a low-wage economy we're being driven into. And what it will mean is frontline staff will have to leave the health service. They'll be driven out of the health service. We won't have ambulance workers. We won't have nurses. We won't have social workers. We won't have admin staff, etc. They'll be driven out because there's no money for them. But they'll still always find money for the consultants. They'll always find money for the latest project that nobody can quite work out what exactly this is supposed to deliver. And what we're saying is that stops. We are not going to cooperate with those sort of projects while frontline workers don't get a penny in their pocket. It's not acceptable and things have to change. The other point I want to make here, Stephen, is we need clarity on what exactly is going on. Our understanding is central government give the Northern Ireland Assembly money to pay these workers, and the Northern Ireland Assembly has taken the decision not to do so. Now, if that is true, that's a very serious situation for a minister. For whatever reason, and I'll not preempt the reasons that he would give, but for whatever reason, we're heading towards a confrontation in public services between the Northern Ireland Assembly and public services. And if there is no... what basis is there to this? The minister needs to pull back. He needs to say he's committed to the health service and he's committed to health service workers.
So what you're looking here is for workers to receive the same pay increase as those workers in England?
As a minimum, yeah. NIPSA's position always has been we want parity plus. And the reason we pose it like that, Stephen, is public service wages in Northern Ireland have fallen way behind over the last 20 years. We want not only to stay level, but to do real catch-up to try and get our people back to where they used to be. Now, I'm sure you're aware of this, Stephen, but public service wages in Northern Ireland are lower today than they were 20 years ago, once you take inflation into account. And isn't that an extraordinary position?
So, if you want at least pay parity, in other words, it's a strong argument. It's a very strong argument where you're saying, why should workers here in this part of the UK not get the same pay increases as England, as yes. other parts of the UK? And that yes. is a very strong argument for you to make. Would you therefore also concede that if you're asking for the same as the UK, then you would support the same revenue raising aspects in the rest of the UK? In other words, if you want the same pay, what about the same charges? So will your union this morning, for example, support the same tuition fees that there are in England? 10 grand against around 5 grand here. The same water charges that there are none here. There are water charges in England. So would you support the same input of money coming into the executive so that they can pay out the same output?
What you're referring to there, Stephen, is the race to the bottom and the game that is played every time there's a discussion around nurses' wages and social workers' wages and frontline services.
No, I'm not.
Workers' wages.
I'm saying that if the executive are to pay out the same, should they take in the same?
No, that's exactly the road you're going down. So let's be clear about something. Northern Ireland Executive has been given the money from Westminster. This is not an either-or choice. They've been given the money.
They've been given a pot of money, which they've got to divvy up.
They have been given a pot of
money. And there isn't enough.
They've been given a pot of money, plus the pay review body, that is a government body, by the way, has recommended 5.5% for all NHS workers. They didn't say just for people in London. They said all NHS workers. They've been given the money to pay that. This is not an either-or choice. And we shouldn't allow ourselves to be driven down some rabbit hole that implies that people in Northern Ireland are somehow scroungers when they're not at all scroungers.
Well, you're just throwing these words out. It's a perfectly fair question for me, Patrick. Does your union support the revenue, the same revenue raising that there is across the water in order to pay out the same level of wages? Is it yes or no?
Let's deal with facts here, Stephen. What you're doing is going down a rabbit hole, and what you're trying to imply is that people in Northern Ireland don't deserve this, that health workers in Northern Ireland don't deserve this, despite the pay review body.
You're trying to diminish the question by attacking me. It's a fair question. But just to get the answer, NIPSA does not support the same revenue raising that's available across the water. Is that right?
I am not trying to divert from any question. What we would like to see is the same level of revenue raising and the same level of expenditure as you would see in the richest parts of London happen in Northern Ireland as well. Let's be honest.
Just the richest
this.
Parts.
Let's be realistic.
But water rates don't apply to just the richest parts, as you know. Tuition fees are 10 grand there, 5 grand here. So that's not just applicable to the richest parts. So are you supporting revenue raising so that staff throughout the public services can get the same level of pay?
Stephen, if you want an answer, you have to let me speak. So let's be very clear about this. The pay review body, a government body, chaired by a government-appointed chairperson, has recommended 5.5% for pay for health service workers. Central government say they have given the money to pay this. That's where we are. That is exactly where we are, Stephen.
So do you think Keith Archibald, the finance minister then, do you think she's making it up when she's saying that they can't afford it?
No, I think that they're left in an invidious situation where they, last year, you'll remember the discussion that took place last year around January, February, Stephen, when the Northern Ireland political parties were engaged in a discussion and a debate with the Tory government at that point in time around the future budget. You will remember when people were calling loudly for the Assembly to come back with the budget, there was an offer from the Tory party. Please let me finish the answer, Stephen. You will remember that NIPSA and myself, we said, do not return until you have a sufficient budget to pay for public services. This is a mistake to return early. And we were berated by the media and berated by political parties who said, no, that's nonsense. We need to get back in. That's all that matters. And we warned we would arrive back at this point because there wasn't sufficient funding in the pot for public services going forward. We have now arrived back at that point. We have proved to be right at that when we made those predictions then. We clearly are back in the same place. We now need to address that. If there is a shortfall, what the Northern Ireland Assembly should be doing now is it should be saying, we are going to set no-cuts budgets in all government departments. We are going to pay workers what they are owed, and we are going to engage with government in Westminster, and we're going to say to them, we need more money back.
Okay.
We have gone through 20 years of austerity. That austerity needs to end. Money needs to be diverted back into the economy. And let's be clear about something, Stephen. See if the government wanted to fight a war somewhere tomorrow. See if they want to fight a war tomorrow. Wouldn't they find the money for it?
So, Patrick, here's my final question to you. Let's step into Mike Nesbitt's shoes, the Health Minister's shoes, for a second. He knows, and the Finance Minister is reminding him and the other ministers in that government, that what the British government, what the Treasury has said, is that Northern Ireland is sitting, it's over £500 million of debt.
Yeah.
And that debt will be wiped off if they keep within their budget this year.
Yes.
And that
yes.
debt will not be wiped off if we overspend.
Yes.
So if Nesbitt overspends, he could be in the position where he's getting the blame for Northern Ireland sitting on over £500 million of debt that otherwise would have been wiped off. So what are you saying to the minister when he says he does not have the money to pay this? He has attacked the executive that he's sitting in. Nesbitt has said that they have willingly decided not to give the health service enough money to pay the workers. So what are you telling Nesbitt to do? Overspend and contribute to Northern Ireland keeping that £500 million of debt? Or if you want them to cut services, which services would you cut?
Well, please let me address each part of this, Stephen. First of all, you're absolutely right. The outgoing government set a trap for the Northern Ireland executive. And the trap was, they had to live within an impossible budget. Everybody knew it was impossible. They had to live within an impossible budget to get the debt wiped out. They baited that trap. Now, to be fair, you would expect that of a Tory government. We now have a new government, and to be fair, the parties in the Northern Ireland Executive expected that new government would deal with some of these issues. It unfortunately hasn't, and we have to reach the point where our executive, our Assembly has to act responsibly, go back to government and say that we cannot work on the basis of this blackmail with this sword of Damocles hanging over our heads all the time. This debt issue needs to be resolved. We need to have flexibility within the budgets. So I think, first of all, we should be saying to the Northern Ireland Executive, go and sort this out. This is what you're elected for. Secondly, on the issue that Mike Nesbitt has raised, I think he would agree with me. Isn't it time that people had some clarity here? Because what Mike Nesbitt is saying is the Northern Ireland Executive was given the money to pay health workers, and now the Executive's refusing to give it to him. So where exactly does that leave us? There, you know, where do we go from here? If he's saying that, and he's the Minister for Health, we're saying, what on earth is going on here that we're back in this situation, not, what, 8 months after the last round of strike action? We're back in this situation where there's an industrial crisis, where there's a political crisis and a financial crisis, and it has to be resolved. The Executive has to explain what's going on. Everybody has to commit to maintaining the direct link of health service pay between Northern Ireland and the UK. We have to maintain that, or we don't have a national health service. And the biggest thing at the end, Stephen, is if we don't pay the workers, just think what's going to happen in A&Es. Just think what will happen in the ambulances. And just think what's going to happen in family and childcare services in Northern Ireland. Children are going to die unless somebody steps up and sorts this mess out.
Patrick, thank you. Justin McCampbell will be speaking to us within the next few seconds. He's from representing the teachers, NASUWT, this morning. Our Business Economics Editor, John Campbell, with us today. Spell out the numbers, John, for us. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, basically, the executive say that they can only afford 3% for pay rises this financial year. The big difficulty they have there is that an independent review body has recommended 5.5% for health workers. But once the monitoring round was done and the money was reallocated earlier this week, Mike Nesbitt basically came out to say, I just don't have the budget cover to do 5.5%. Then we look at some of the other groups. So there isn't a pay review body for the civil service. So those are the officials directly employed by the Stormont departments. But if we look at equivalent workers in Whitehall and UK central government departments, they are being offered around 5%. And again, Stormont saying, well, we can only do 3%, although we would like to do more. And then when we come to the teachers, they're looking for a very large rise. They're looking for over 13%. I'm sure you'll ask Justin about that in a moment. But their justification for that is to say, this is to make up for a big legacy of at and below inflation pay rises, which has caused the value of teachers' pay to be eroded. And clearly, I think the Education Minister, Paul Given, will be saying, listen, there's no way I'm going to be able to afford anything like that. So we are now into a negotiation about what exactly can be afforded and how any potential deals can be structured.
Well, let's speak to him now. John, thank you for that. Justin McCampbell from the NASUWT. You know you're not going to get 13%. You know it, Justin, right?
Good morning, Stephen. I think listeners need to bear in mind that there's a variety of mechanisms for negotiating pay across the public sector in Northern Ireland and the UK. Other bodies may have a pay review body system where an expert group looks at it. We are in a collective bargaining situation. We have to go in with an opening position. We've done that. The employers now need to make an offer, and they haven't made an offer. And the reason they haven't made an offer, nothing to do with them personally, it's because they haven't been provided with the money from the executive with which to make that offer.
So, sounds from what you've just said there that you're understanding the position Paul Given, the education minister, is in. If your members follow through and strike, just Patrick Mulholland is using language this morning of making the government squeal, hurting, you know, the strikes need to be designed to hurt. Are you of the same view?
I don't think there's any point in coming, get me on to say what I think or don't think about, you know, what action NIPS has taken.
I'm asking about the NASUWT. Are you going to strike to hurt?
We're striving to get a better deal for our members. There's no intent in any of this to hurt anyone. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be hurt caused, but that's not our intention in doing this. We're hoping that the Minister can get around the executive table and get the resources that teachers in Northern Ireland are no longer the worst paid teachers in the UK.
What are the terms and conditions like in Northern Ireland compared to England?
They're broadly comparable in terms of hours, days, the type of activities that a teacher can reasonably be directed to do. Sorry, I should have clarified, they're broadly comparable with England and Wales. Scotland's conditions are better than those in Northern Ireland as well as the pay.
So to be clear, the NASUWT would accept the same terms and conditions as England if you got the same pay?
It depends what you mean by terms and conditions. In terms of the overall contract, that's something that we are open to discussing. The teaching contract in England isn't perfect either, and neither is ours. We should be looking at the contract, but we also should be looking at pay, which is the here and now of how people are going to put bread on the table, pay the rent, pay the mortgage.
What are we looking at here, Justin, in terms of the possibility of strike action? What would it look like? When would it happen?
Well, it would be unlikely to have a strike before the new year because our process means that we have to give a legal notification of a week to the minister and the employers. We then have to have a period for a ballot to be carried out. We've decided to go with a 3-week period, which would take us up to the 16th of December. We don't intend to strike in the run-up to Christmas, which would impact nativity plays and those type of things, which we know parents and young people enjoy. So in reality, you would be looking after Christmas.
And what would those be? Half days rather than full day education? Would you pull the staff out completely for some days? What are you looking at?
We haven't made those decisions yet. And again, it's not just our union. There are two other unions balloting, and a fourth will be balloting very soon. And we are committed to working, you know, closely with each other so that whatever we do together so that it can have a maximum impact.
But that maximum impact...
We are talking to those other unions, and we can assure teachers that we'll go forward together in this one.
But that maximum impact, Justin, ultimately would impact children and parents first, wouldn't it?
It would, if we, in terms of strike. There's also the option of action, short of strike, that we'll be looking at as well.
What would that be?
I think the important thing to say is we don't want any of this. We want our teachers to be rewarded for the work that we do, and there's still time for the minister to make sure an offer's made strike and action short of strike can be avoided. In terms of what action short of strike is, it's withdrawing from certain activities that a teacher may be asked to do and saying, no, I'm not taking part in that activity.
Like what? Marking homework? Like extracurricular activities? Getting people...
Yes, all those things. Now, that, because I'm saying yes to those doesn't mean I'm saying those would be in the action short of strike. But those type of activities that teachers quite often are asked to do above and beyond.
Engaging children in sport, engaging children in after-class activities which make them enjoy school. So it's the kids here.
I think it's important to say, Stephen, that we've never actually included those in any action.
So can you rule them out?
Well, you can't rule anything out, but it doesn't mean you can jump and say here's an explicit the NASUWT is going to tell members not to do.
No, I'm trying to get a sense for parents this morning. What is on the table here? That's all I'm doing.
Yeah, well, we have to sit down with our own executive committee. We'll talk to the other unions as well and come up with a coordinated plan of what teachers would withdraw from if necessary.
And the same question to you, Justin, as I asked your union colleague, Patrick Mulholland from NIPSA. To get the same pay as across the water, would you accept not just the same terms and conditions, but would your union accept Stormont raising revenue, bring the money in order to churn it out? Like a slot machine. It gathers money and then it churns it out. So if there's no money in the machine, if there's not enough money in the machine, they can't churn it out. So would the NASUWT support government ministers in the executive saying, OK, look, we accept pay parity so much. This is tough, but we're going to impose whatever it is. Water charges, we're going to put rates up even more. Tuition fees, we can't afford $5,000 compared to $10,000. If we're paying the same out, Northern Ireland's going to have to fundamentally change in terms of what we bring in. Would you support that principle?
I think I could safely say we support the principle of the executive looking at all income and expenditure. I think that difference with saying just make it the same as England is that our revenue raising or expenditure is structured in very different ways. We know, for example, in Northern Ireland that there's a rates cap on homes over £400,000 as of the 2005 valuation. We know the Minister of Finance has launched a review into that. So there are things that can be done, but I don't think I have time now to prescribe what I believe each of those should be. But, you know, a responsible government does have to look at these things. But they can't punish people either. You know, when it comes to water charges, we have to remember that we already pay for water through a rates bill. And it's not just a simple matter of saying...
But we don't have enough to fix the infrastructure, do we? We don't have enough. The finance minister is saying, even with the extra money that we've got from across the water, we're short. So something has to give here. Either they bring in more revenue, or they cut services, or they don't give the workers the pay that you're asking for. Like, there's a tough decision somewhere along the line here.
Well, I haven't said, don't look at those things. Those things do need to be considered in the round by the executive. The priority for our members is ensuring that A, they get paid, and B, that they're in a position to deliver the best for the young people that they teach.
When you're sitting down, then the real politic of this, Justin. So when you're sitting down negotiating with Paul Given, the minister, and he's sitting opposite you, and you see him as the not just the post, but the human being, and the man who's actually legally responsible to act within his budget. What are you saying to him? Are you saying, Minister, bust the budget?
We're saying to the Minister, I think it's not just his budget. There's an overall budget, and we're saying that the executive as a whole needs to take responsibility.
But my question was precise for a reason, Justin.
Sometimes it is easy to pick on one minister, but it is the whole executive decision.
Yeah, but my question was precise for a reason, because that's the reality of what will happen here. Paul Given is responsible for the education budget. You will be negotiating, not with the entire executive, you will be sitting in front of the minister. So what are you saying to that DUP minister who has the power to make the decision? Are you telling him to bust the budget, or are you understanding that he can't? Or shouldn't?
I think we're saying for us, the priority is delivering on pay. How he does that is for him to decide, whether that, as you say, is busting the budget.
So would you support him busting the budget and therefore jeopardising that £500 million debt that may not therefore be written off by the Treasury? Are you telling him to take that gamble?
I don't think, Stephen, it's always that black and white. We do value the government we have in Northern Ireland, and we do think the devolved government is the best thing for workers in Northern Ireland. So we're not getting into saying bust the budget. You know,
okay.
If we go too far down that line, you know, we start to have an unstable government.
Okay, so
again,
what do you expect? If Paul doesn't bust the budget in order to give teachers the pay rise that you say they deserve, and I've said this morning, it's a very valid argument, isn't it? Give us the same as what workers are getting across the water. So if Paul does not bust the budget, if he lives within his budget and he's not given more money by Kiva Archibald, then his next decision is, if I pay these workers, I need to cut services within the education department. Which would you recommend he cuts to give you the pay rise?
Well, Stephen, we don't assume access to budgeting information that the minister does, but we're not going to get into saying what we think should be cut. Our priority remains at delivery for our members. We fully understand the ministers are in an invidious position. They are. But
I'm asking you what decision are you recommending? You cannot just sit in front of the minister and say, la-di-da-di-da, sing kumbaya, come up with a decision without understanding what is available to him. So he either busts the budget, he doesn't give you the pay rise, he does give you the pay rise and cuts other services. Which are you recommending?
Well, for us, the priority is paying teachers, because if we don't pay teachers, teachers leave the profession, teachers leave the country, they go to teach elsewhere. We already know in post-primary schools, we can't recruit teachers in some subjects. That's going to get worse if we don't deliver on pay.
Okay, Justin, thank you very much. Morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. We'll pause for the news at 9:35. Well, what do you all think this morning How is it too much to ask for workers that are getting up in the morning here, those valuable workers like teachers, like our doctors, our nurses, our hospital porters, civil servants? Why should they get up in the morning and not get the same pay rises that England's getting if we're part of the UK? But then, as I've been trying to introduce as a question this morning, in order to pay them that, why are we not paying the same out in terms of what Stormont charges us as the rest of the UK? Jim in Lisburn. Morning, Jim.
Oh, hi, Stephen. Just listening to that whole conversation there, talking about revenue raising. One substantial difference between us and the rest of the UK is businesses in the UK have been enjoying very substantial rates relief for the last number of years.
That's right.
We haven't been getting that in Northern Ireland.
That's right.
So there's extra revenue that we get that they don't get in England. And also, in England, you know, we don't carve up the country by this county, that county, the other county, and say, oh, Yorkshire's not paying its way, but, you know, Lincoln does. The UK government spread it out around everyone regardless.
Well, we are getting the revenue which could be used for business relief here in Northern Ireland. It is the Northern Ireland Executive. It is Stormont which is deciding not to support local businesses in that way. Wayne, next morning, Wayne.
Stephen, if we're all under one umbrella, according to the situation regarding health and education, when pay rises come in, why are they not just paid straight from England? Take it out of Stormont's hands. Wouldn't have this problem.
Well, it's called devolution.
Yeah, but it's called basically as well, not fit for purpose. It's not fit for purpose. And every morning you come on and you have a problem and it always comes back not fit for purpose.
No, these are decisions. These are local decisions which your locally accountable politicians are making. So, for example, as we've just described, Wayne, local politicians here are deciding not to support small businesses here with business relief that is across the water. So, yes, if you want to load that into contemporary times, that's a border which Stormont has put down the Irish Sea in terms of business tax relief. That's a border that the DUP have supported in terms of a difference between England and those businesses there getting business tax relief and here in Northern Ireland. But to be fair to them, it's called devolution. What's the point of Stormont if they don't make local decisions?
Well, I don't honestly see any point of Stormont, Stephen, because to be quite honest with you, at any given time, they can walk out again, which left us in this problem, which 5 years of no government, no money issued, all these problems mightn't be as bad now. But they walk out, and then they go out for maybe 2.5 years, and it takes them that long to get a pay cut. The only people that suffer is the people in the bottom, and they go back and say, let's play happy families for an hour.
So what do you think these ministers should do? You've got Patrick Mulholland from NHPSA representing some of the health workers saying their strike action will hurt. It'll be designed to hurt. And he's saying that he wants to make government squeal. And he's saying he's doing that just to get pay parity, just to get paid the same as the rest of and across the water. So do you support him?
I think he should, yes. I think there's about time Stormont learned to grow up. Because I'll tell you something, the way they run this country, an ordinary person wouldn't run a house. Because it's absolutely shameful. All they would do is worry every time they take a notion, one of them goes out and they're not in government. 5 years, we pay the price for it. These are not just things that happened overnight. These are things of years of wrong, bad government.
Sean's calling us from Dublin this morning. Morning, Sean.
Hey, Stephen.
Go ahead.
It's just a bit puzzling from this side of the border, Stephen.
Well, that's because you lot are so rolling in money, you don't know what to do with it.
That's a good joke, yeah. Right.
The Irish government has got so much excess funds. You actually send some of it up here.
That is a fact, yeah. But here's the point. Everybody makes the same contribution down here. How can you expect people to be paid the same pay as in Britain or in England, as you say, when you're not making the same contributions? I mean, sure, there has to be some connection.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, how can you expect to be paying less and then receiving the same payment? Sure, as the man says, it just doesn't add up.
Okay, Sean, thank you. Matthew Robinson from Northern Ireland Conservatives. Morning, Matthew.
Good morning, Stephen.
How do we square this circle? And look, is it really that much for workers to ask for the same pay as anybody else? Well, why should Northern Ireland be cheap?
I think you framed this debate in the correct way. I think from the outset, it should be said, I think the 5.5% recommendation from the independent pay review body as it relates to health workers is fair. But unfortunately, the health minister here, Mike Nesbitt, I think has been dealt a bad hand. It's Stormont, after decades of mismanagement and neglect, have found themselves in this position as the health minister currently faces a 100 million shortfall. But this is all about choices. It's about devolution. And you look at the host of things that Stormont time and time again step in and subsidise, whether even aspects of trying to mitigate the UK government's decision on winter fuel. But you date way back to a new decade, new approach. Things like the spare room subsidy, or what was called the bedroom tax, Northern Ireland Executive have continued to mitigate for elements like tuition fees, lack of local revenue raising. It goes on and on and on. But our local politicians here dodge difficult spending decisions. That's the reality of it. And by the way, not dissimilar to what Labour is doing, you can throw as much money at the health service in Northern Ireland as you want, but until we have a comprehensive review and root and branch reform in the vogue of the Bengoa recommendations, it's going to be good money after bad. We need to implement comprehensive reform this money is just going to be wasted year on year out. I'd be curious to see the outcome of the negotiations this morning, but the health minister, I think, is in, like a lot of his colleagues around the executive, in an impossible situation due to the mess that the Stormont executive has found itself in.
Matthew, thank you. Brian and Enniskillen. Morning, Brian. Good morning, Brian. Okay, Brian's not there. Right. Shall we move on this morning? 030-30-80-55-55. Fresh controversy at Stormont over this meeting between Michelle O'Neill and Paula Bradshaw. The First Minister's office has refused to disclose an official's handwritten notes of the meeting last month following a Freedom of Information request by David Thompson at the newsletter in response to the FOI. So this was the meeting. Let's set this out. This was the meeting that some members of the committee were raging about because they found out just minutes before the meeting that Paula Bradshaw was meeting up with Michelle O'Neill about questions that Michelle was going to be answering around safeguarding and after the whole Michael McMonagall affair and Sinn Féin's handling of it. And in response, so what happened in that meeting between Michelle O'Neill and Paula Bradshaw? Well, people asked for the minutes so they could see what was happening. In response to the FOI from the newsletter, the First Minister's private office said, wait for this, contemporaneous notes were being withheld because they fell under an exemption which they say relates to the operation of a ministerial private office. So what they're saying, so what the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, who is saying that she's being as transparent as possible, her office, her private office, is saying, well, when there's a civil servant there taking those notes of what's happening in that meeting, no, you can't have them. No, the public cannot see them because it's not in the public interest, it's not in your interest to see the notes. And the refusal letter continues, any note taken by the minister's principal private secretary clearly relates to the operation of a ministerial private office. Taking a handwritten note is a purely administrative task, being the necessary first step towards the production of the official note of the meeting. In the executive office's view, the content of a written handwritten note is therefore clearly exempt under section 35(1)(d). So they won't let any of you see the handwritten notes. Well, the reason why that's really interesting is because meanwhile, at the Department of Education, Paul Given's department, we've been talking a lot about Paul today, haven't we? They do release handwritten notes. They have released them. Do you remember the meeting that Paul Given had with the LCC? Now, heavily redacted, I might add, but they did release. Oh, the handwritten note wasn't redacted. It was actually the minutes was heavily redacted. But the handwritten notes, they did release. So how do you have one department releasing the handwritten notes from an official. And meanwhile, the Department of Education, they release them, and Michelle O'Neill's department does not. Why the difference? So let's remind ourselves of the context again. This is Paula Bradshaw, Chair of the Executive Office Committee, meeting with Michelle O'Neill just hours before the First Minister was due to face questions last month over those recent scandals embroiling Sinn Féin. There has been another political row. Let's dip into it and listen to it. When the TV's Timothy Gaston proposed that handwritten notes should be shared with the Executive Committee.
And putting the proposal back to onto the agenda and to the meeting that that we seek from the Executive Office, where the newsletter is filed and their FOI, all the written notes that were taken during that meeting. And if they don't want to release them to us, we have powers to compel them, and I trust the committee would be serious enough to cite the powers that we have and the letter that we send to them.
That's fine. Carol, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm not picking up what Timothy's proposal is. Is he proposing that because the journalists couldn't get notes for a while that we send them on? I'm not really clear. It broke off a wee bit. Sorry, but...
We request the notes on behalf of the committee. If they haven't been released via FOI to somebody that's sought them outside of Stormont, outside of the committee, I think there's an onus on this committee because the meeting dealt exactly with business or directly with business of this committee that we
seek
them.
No, it didn't. You're trying to imply that we engage in some sort of conspiracy.
No.
Yes, you are.
Sure. If someone hasn't been able to request something from the ICO, is that not the ICO's responsibility?
Yes. Let me just let Carol finish and then I'll bring you in, Claire, for that question. Pardon. Go ahead, Carol.
No, Claire's made the point. Our job isn't to do a job for a journalist. If they're not happy with the information, they go to the Information Commissioner. I wouldn't be in favour of that. I think that's just bonkers, to be honest.
Yeah. My proposal still stands.
Well,
we request them as a committee.
I think that all you're trying to do is just frustrate this committee.
No, it's not.
There's nothing. When I saw the minutes that were produced, I thought there was bits, and I thought, oh, I forgot that was. Honestly, they were a complete record of what happened that day.
Then there should be no reason.
Well, there isn't any issue, but I think all you're trying to do is frustrate everything.
I'm unclear. Release what?
He thinks that there's stuff.
Handwritten notes. The newsletter had requested the handwritten notes.
We're not here to do the job of the newsletter.
Oh, I know we're not. But
well, you are, but the rest of us aren't.
No, but why wouldn't they release the MTN? It doesn't matter who they came from.
Have you written to the Executive Office yourself?
Nothing to do with us.
But this is a committee. This meeting that took place was directly linked to this committee, but a witness that was coming here. And I think this committee should ask for the correspondence that they're refusing to release to a member of the public.
We actually don't know that, Chair. The reality of the situation is that if somebody makes a request for freedom of information and they're dissatisfied, there is a very clear and well-established route for them to go down to do that.
Well, then I'm asking as a member of this committee, on behalf of the committee, I put a proposal that we should ask for.
Well, I think that I'm not interested in that because I don't think that there's anything to be gained from this. See, all you're trying to do is continuously frustrate this committee.
Absolutely not. You being the chair and being involved, I thought you would have been one.
I have no problem with it, but I think that you're just trying to create a false narrative every week, straight to the newsletter and other outlets to try and undermine this committee.
No, absolutely not.
Well, the TV proposal, and that's Timothy Gaston you were hearing there from the TV, was supported by the DUP's Brian Kingston. All other members of the committee blocked the move. Here's how Sinn Féin's Emma Sheeran responded.
I'm confused.com. So we got the typed up minutes.
Mm.
So you want somebody's handwritten?
Why wouldn't
I've never sent minutes to anybody in my life in my handwritten form. I type them up so that people can read them clearly. I don't understand.
There'd be no issue requesting
the chair. I know, but you're at this stage now. You're veering into questioning the integrity of the chair. She said that they reflect the content of the meeting. She said that multiple times, and she was at the meeting. So if you have an allegation or some sort of question as to what the chair has reflected,
simply asking for the public.
Well, you've already been told that there's a route for you to do that. So go down that line.
So this is what's going on behind the scenes in your committees at Stormont. But what about the fundamental question? Why are you, the public, not able to see notes that civil servants, who are independent, impartial, what they're writing down? Why not? They're being blocked by Michelle O'Neill's department at the moment. Martin Rosenbaum is a FOI expert. I asked him about the First Minister's office saying handwritten notes might not be released.
So handwritten notes aren't automatically exempt from the FOI rules. What happens in situations like this is that the executive has to decide whether it's in the public interest or not to release them. They're not automatically outside FOI. It's got to be decided on a case-by-case basis, this kind of stuff. Is it in the public interest that the public are better informed about what's going on, or do the officials need to keep certain things secret? That's what they've got to assess.
So the refusal letter to the newsletter, a journalist called David Thompson, the newsletter says, any note taken by the minister's principal private secretary clearly relates to the operation of a ministerial private office. Taking a handwritten note is a purely administrative task, being the necessary first step towards the production of the official note of the meeting. In the executive office view, the content of a handwritten note is therefore clearly exempt under section 35(1)(d).
So that's not enough. That's not a complete statement of the law. It's possible that you could hold back something which is to do with the workings of a ministerial private office, as they're saying, but only if it's considered to be against the public interest. So if you've got a particular case, for example, maybe, you know, as here, a very controversial meeting, people might want to compare the handwritten notes against the official record, check that the official record is complete and accurate. It may well be, under those circumstances, in the public interest that that should be out, so the public can properly scrutinise whether or not the official record is correct.
So what we have in this situation, Martin, is we have many political parties who did not know that a meeting was taking place before a committee meeting between the First Minister, who was the witness, Michelle O'Neill, and Paula Bradshaw, who was the chair. The other committee meetings members did not know that this meeting was happening until about 10 minutes before the committee meeting was due to start. And they're intrigued. What was actually said? What wasn't said? So they've asked for the minutes. They've asked for the handwritten notes. They've got the minutes, which, to be honest, don't say very much. And the handwritten notes won't be released. Is it in the public interest to withhold them?
Well, I would say there's a very strong public interest for releasing them. I mean, the situation you're describing there certainly seems to me to be a very peculiar, unusual situation. And it's not surprising that people are asking questions about it. And people, you know, it's perfectly reasonable that people will know, well, exactly what happened in the meeting, exactly what was said. This official minute that we've been given, is that necessarily a full and accurate account of the entire thing? We want to see the contemporaneous notes so that we can judge that for ourselves in this very unusual situation, which raises a lot of very puzzling and intriguing questions. So I think there's a very strong case in the public interest for releasing these notes. And there definitely is a precedent for releasing contemporaneous notes where the overall public interest demands it. It's not something that would be unprecedented, far from it. When there are unusual, particularly puzzling and controversial situations, there's a very strong public interest for doing so.
We know that the Department of Education released handwritten notes about a meeting that their minister had, Paul Given, the Minister for Education, had with the LCC. So you've got one department releasing them and another not. Is there anything different about the private office that's not releasing them?
Well, I've got to say I'm not personally familiar with the Department for Education situation that you've described. But what it does do is it illustrates the general principle, which is notes like this can be released sometimes. And the difference can only lie in this overall question of the public interest, which is the test, the legal test that the law imposes for the release of information of this kind. And the Department for Education situation you're describing shows that there is indeed a precedent for doing this kind of, for releasing this kind of information. And what we have here that is the core of the current controversy seems to me to be, you know, exactly the kind of controversial case, puzzling case, where there are questions that need to be answered, where information of this kind should be out in the open.
Just one final question, Martin. What are minutes actually supposed to show? Because I'm seeing so many minutes now from government where they tell us that something was discussed, but they don't tell us what was discussed. They don't go into the detail of what was discussed, and they don't go into sometimes the decisions that were made. So such and such was discussed. How does that help the public?
That doesn't help the public at all. That's a completely inadequate record of a meeting when you have that kind of thing. And it's when you have minutes that are particularly vague and insubstantial, it's when people most want to see, well, what was the handwritten notes of the people there? What were they actually writing down? So I think I agree with you about that, Stephen, that you do get minutes which are completely inadequate as a record of what actually happened. And people must have their own private records of what happened at that meeting so that they know what to do and how to implement the decisions and a record of what was actually decided and so on and who said what and all the rest of it.
Okay.
So, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very important point.
Is it legal to have your own private version?
It is legal, but it could still end up that you have to release it if it's in line, as I say, with the overall balance of the public interest. So the fact that you've got your own private version doesn't mean that it's outside the FOI law. You've still compiled that in line with your work, your professional duties, the sort of meetings we're talking about. So you might think it's private to me, but it still could be released under FOI. It's not totally exempt from FOI.
And if we come full circle, finally, to what is at stake here, it is the reputation, some people would argue, for Stormont. It is political parties, some of them saying, hold on, we want to know the detail of the discussion between the chair of a committee and the First Minister. That's about the integrity of Stormont, the perception of the integrity of it, the perception that the public will be given information about their lives. Can you see any appeal to that FOI feeling now that the private office has turned, the executive office has turned down releasing them?
Well, I think if it went to the Information Commissioner's Office, which regulates FOI, then I think they'd see a very strong case for releasing the full contemporaneous minutes, because this is about the role of a committee in scrutinising what the people in power are doing so that the public know what is going on and people are accountable for the decisions they are taking. So, in other words, the entire purpose of this committee is about scrutiny and openness and accountability and transparency. So I do think it goes right to the heart of what this committee is doing.
Martin, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today at 10:04, the Nolan Show from the BBC. New figures show that more than £500 million has been spent on trying to fix Northern Ireland's roads during the last 5 years. Mid Ulster, the place where the largest amount of money was spent, and yet it still has the highest number of potholes in Northern Ireland. This is a story that our Mid Ulster reporter Niall McCracken has been looking into. You can see his online piece on the BBC News website. It's a good opportunity for us to talk together today, isn't it, about potholes and the state of the roads where you live, wherever it is in Northern Ireland. Last month, the Mineral Products Association told a Stormont committee that our roads network in Northern Ireland is facing its biggest funding crisis in over 50 years. DFI figures show there have been almost 120,000 road defects and potholes recorded in Northern Ireland since January this year. 120,000 road defects, potholes this year. What do we do about that? Francis Scullion, driver with Out and About in Macrofelt. Morning, Francis.
Good morning, Stephen.
My goodness. Well, you're out and about, you're a driver. What are you experiencing?
Well, we'd be out each day and we'd probably do about 120 miles on these rural roads. And we're a charitable organisation who provides much needed transport to the disabled, elderly and the most vulnerable people in our society, to much needed health appointments, getting their groceries, among many other needs that they have. Every day we're hitting potholes, the edges of the roads have sunk away. We have to slow up our journeys, which is meaning we can't get as many customer uses timetable during the day because of our slow travel times. And
how deep are these things? How bad are they?
Well, they can be really deep. The edges of the roads can be gone. You could be talking, edges of roads could be going in 200, 300 millimetres at the very extremes. We can't drive over these. We have to move out onto the middle of the road or give way for oncoming traffic if there is. Whenever we drive, we constantly scan the road to see these waves and the bumps and the defects. But, you know, you can't do that when it's foggy, when it's dark. You know, maybe you're getting blinded by oncoming lights.
Yeah. And have you had wheels wrecked?
Oh, yes, we have wheels. You'd have wheels, suspension, everything gets excessive use and damage. We've had a new bus there, probably probably 2 or 3 months old, and she's had mountains belonging to the suspension broke.
Like down where I live at Mahee Island, there's a big one. I had a burst tire. I drove over it, tire burst, wheel, yes. Tire wrecked.
Yeah, our biggest problem would be in the longer term. Gillian here, who manages the Out and About in Macrofelt, has been very successful in securing funding for new vehicles. But it's very sad for us to go out driving each day, knowing that we are going to do excessive wear to these vehicles. And where do you go in 2 or 3 years' time? You know, when this escalating maintenance costs, they do it at present, go through a 10-week robust maintenance procedure. But every penny counts in this business and that there, and there's not going to be that loose flush of money to meet these demands for the repairs.
The SDLP, Councillor Malachy Quinn, also joining us this morning. Francis, I know you have to get out and about this morning, so we'll say thank you to you. Malachy, morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Like, is this insurmountable now? 120,000 road defects, potholes, since January this year reported? Huge.
It seems never-ending, to be perfectly honest, Stephen. I know people give a lot of local councillors stick because they seem to be only complaining about potholes, but you just give the figures there. It is the most mentioned issue to me as a councillor, and I've been a councillor over 11 years. There's not a day goes by that somebody hasn't contacted me or messaged me or pointed out there's a pothole such and such, it needs repaired, and it is just an ongoing issue. And particularly here in Mid-Ulster, as you see from Niall's report, it's just getting absolutely ridiculous now at this point, and the amount of tyres that have burst and springs that have been broken, it's hard to count it all up.
I saw you climbing into a hole, didn't I?
Yeah, did indeed. That was last summer. So that was a hole that opened up on the ferry road. Like, I'm 6 foot tall, so I was able to get quite a bit of myself into that hole, and I had trouble getting back out of it again, to be perfectly honest. But that's just an example. And the ferry road is very famous, particularly to DFI, because of the amount of complaints that are put into it. And a lorry might pass over that okay, but a car or a bicycle, if somebody doesn't know the road and they hit that, a burst tyre is the last thing they're going to be worried about.
So just to explain to people, this hole you climbed into, I'm just looking at a photograph of it now, it was up to your belly button, basically,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And they filled it in, and here you are back again, and it's opening up again, correct?
Yep, 100%. Yes, starting to open up again in the exact same spot. And that's just one of many holes, unfortunately, down the ferry road. And it's just a standard road.
So here's the question I have, and it's the same about down where I live. 2024, all of the modern technology, the science, we can fly people into space now and everything that's happening. How come when we fix potholes, they open up again a few months or a year later? Like, I genuinely don't understand that. What's going on?
Has
humankind not invented something where you fix something and it stays fixed?
It's just not like that's an extreme example of that hole in the ferry road. But there's a amount of potholes that have opened up around my area around Cull Island and down on the Washing Bay, etc., that they're filled in. And what they fill it in with is a hot topic, to be honest with people, because I honestly don't believe it's a great material that they use. They fill the pothole in, and maybe 3 weeks later, the pothole has reopened. And it seems to be some sort of substance that they put in that's not up to standard, especially on rural roads, and the amount of users that are going over it. And it seems to be a cycle. Fill it in, repeat, come back a couple of months later, do it all again.
Well, clearly it's up to standard. because the standard would be controlled by the department, the government department that's paying for it. So it is up to standard. I guess the question I'm asking, and I genuinely don't know the answer to this, so we should try to find out, is there a more expensive material that could be used that equally is off standard but is better than the minimum standard that would last longer? Like, I don't know, but I do know over all of the years that I've been driving up and down that Cumber Road. So along that Cumber Road, there are accidents on that road, for example. There are major potholes. You swerve around them, you're in trouble. But how come they open up again? How are we not getting that question answered? And they're not opening up after 10 years. They're opening up after months.
No, I hear a month. You're happy enough to get a month out of it, Stephen, to be perfectly honest. I've seen holes open up after weeks. And that's the God's honest truth. We asked ourselves the same question. 2024, surely there's a better system or something that we can do to stop these opening up again. And I understand there's a lot of traffic, and I understand we have extreme weather conditions sometimes in this country. But particularly now going into winter, all those potholes that are currently there, they're only going to get worse, and they are going to get worse faster than they would have during the summer or spring. And that's a real concern for people. And as you mentioned, you're swerving to avoid potholes.
Yeah.
What happens if somebody panics? They don't know the road, they panic and see it late, and there's maybe oncoming
traffic
towards them.
They're in trouble. That's how important this is, you know. Okay, thank you. Good reporting by our Mid-Ulster reporter, Niall McCracken, as well. And we'll try to delve into, look, are other countries using better material? We asked the minister, who's that? So down again, isn't it? John O'Dowd to come on. He doesn't have the time to come on this morning. I was talking on the phone last night and someone was saying to us, keep doing the traffic story. Were any of you gripped in traffic deadlock last night again? I was. I don't know. Right, let's hear from all of you. Apparently we only asked John to come on this morning. Maybe come on some other day. Let's see. Helen in Enniskillen. Morning, Helen.
Hi, Stephen. How are you doing?
Good morning. This is about these freedom of information requests and the handwritten notes now from Michelle O'Neill's department. Michelle O'Neill being as transparent as possible, but her department doesn't want to release the handwritten notes that were taken by a civil servant, just in case you see them, Helen. Everybody else sees them.
That's slightly confused, and I don't know how it is, but sorry, it's the Department of Health, Stephen. The Department of Health have refused to enter into any conversation with myself or any other person in relation to requests for information regarding the temporary withdrawal of services and surgical services at SWA, which to me is just an abuse of the Nolan principles. I don't think there's any openness and accountability and honesty in accessing information which we should be democratically and justly entitled to ask for. But they've actually called our area and the topic vexatious, rather than calling me as a person vexatious. And I'm one of three people who have now been sent the same script.
So were you asking about information about your medical records?
No, this was freedom of information. It was freedom of information. And it was from the Department of Health.
Well, I would need to see the details around what you're asking, to be fair to them, and derogations around that. Maybe we'll look at that behind the scenes, Helen. I don't think it's fair to the Department of Health before we have that detail.
I'm happy, Stephen. I'll tell you what, there was actually an article on it in the Belfast Telegraph, where the department are aware of it. But basically, these are questions which are about survival for people in this population down here. And as I said, they literally, it's just an abject refusal.
Well, Helen, let me pause you there. I'm not comfortable until I see the detail here, but thank you for calling us. We'll have a look at the detail of what you're saying and give the Department of Health a chance to respond as well. I think that's the best way to go forward. John and Lisburn, morning, John.
Good morning.
Morning. Potholes.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
You're talking there about potholes. Well, now, let's be honest, a lot of the potholes are wear and tear and but a lot of them are down to these multi-million pound utility companies who come along, dig up a road, dig a manhole in the middle of it, or dig a track across the road. They cover it over, and good enough job for a week or two, and a month later, the whole thing's turned into potholes.
Come on. You must be making that up. There must be
standards. I live on a road that was resurfaced.
There must be standards.
A month later, they came along and dug a track up one side of it. 6 weeks later, they come along and dug the same track up again because they'd made a mistake with the size of pipe. And 6 months later, they come along and they dug up the other side of it. Now, that's 2 years ago, two and a half, maybe years ago. Now, you can hardly drive up the road. There's potholes on every side of it. And it's down to the fact that the tracks have opened up here and there. And anybody will tell you, when you see a hole been dug for to put a track in or whatever, you can be 100% sure that before 6 months' time, that track will be full of potholes.
Well, I just don't... Look, there must be standards of filling in holes.
Well, where are they?
Well, it's up to us to try to find them for you, isn't it?
Well, I don't know now. It's not hard to fill in a hole, you know, if you're filling it in with the right stuff.
But I'm sorry.
I do know a wee bit about it. If you're going to dig a hole, first of all, you dig it out. You dig the rubbish out of it. Now, I see them filling in holes and they come along with a thing like a Hoover in reverse and they blow a lot of, well, we'll keep our language right, but they basically blow a lot of rubbish into it and 2 days later, my hole's out again.
Oh, come on.
Well, now, do you use the road?
You're an expert.
I do a fair bit of miles every day.
Yes, but how are you an expert, John? John, how are you an expert in holes? Do not be ridiculous.
I can see. Well, I tell you, you pick a spot today somewhere where some utility company is digging up the road, and you go back and 2 months later and see how lovely and how well reinstated it is, because you'll find that half of it has come out again.
But why?
It's not done right.
But is it that it's not? It couldn't be. We have so many potholes that are opening.
Oh, we'll not go there. We'll not go
but
there.
But we have so many of them that are opening up again.
Yes.
That it couldn't be that they're all just filling the holes in wrong. There must be some impossibility to this, that they just, that no country in the world
the standard
can put.
The standard of reinstating is not good enough.
Well, is it that?
Utility companies should not be able to come along and dig up a road or an entrance into a housing estate or whatever the case may be and cover it over or reinstate it good enough at the time. There's no doubt about that. It obviously has passed a certain standard at the time. But they should be responsible for that for 2, 4, 6, whatever number
of years. Well, there's
an idea. They shouldn't be able to just walk away and leave it to the council to rein up their mess after them in a month's time.
Well, there's an idea. So what about this for an idea? That the companies that are being paid to fill in the holes, that they have an ongoing maintenance responsibility chargeable to them if the hole opens up within whatever amount of time, 2 years, 5 years.
100%. Why should we be paying for it?
Well, I don't even know if that's not the case. I don't know enough about this. I don't know enough about it. We're going to have to find out.
Well, now, you only have to drive up the road. I told you there now what to do. Look at somewhere that's being done today.
Do you think I live on...
If you reinstate it, just keep a wee eye on it to see how long it is reinstated.
Do you think I live on a fantasy island on a different planet? Do you actually think I don't drive the roads?
I don't know where I live.
Well, why are you presuming I don't drive over potholes? So where I live, you go down the Cumber Road, there's usually a pothole on the right-hand side heading from Belfast direction to Cumber, which is, and the speed limit along some of that road is 60 mile an hour. So you're sometimes driving at 60 mile an hour, pothole, right? Then you get down to Mahee Island. It's like wacky races down there.
Well, I don't know that road.
Avoiding the potholes. And it's a wee thin road. Listen to me. It's a wee thin road. Listen to me a minute.
Go ahead.
There's a wee thin road.
Right.
On the way to Nendrum. That's where I live, down Fantasy Island, right?
Wouldn't be familiar with it.
Hold on a minute. I'm trying to tell you about it.
Right.
Are you not allowed to talk in the house?
Oh, but I like to get my point. You don't give me very long.
Hold on,
like
I'm going to give you a minute. Right? The whole point about this road down to where I live is you can't swerve to the left because guess what's on your left? Strangford Lock. There's water on your left.
Well, there you go.
So you can't swerve.
Yes. But now you said something there, and I have to pick you up on it.
This man's doing my head in.
You said that you were driving along at 60 mile an hour.
No, the Cumber Road.
Around Cumber.
Yes.
Now,
Cumber Road.
I go from Lisburn to Cumber, and I don't really know a part of it where you could get up to 60 mile an hour.
I don't know if it's called the Cumber Road, but there's a road somewhere around there where the speed limit's 60 and there's often a pothole. And then, so it's just...
Well, the speed limit on most of them roads is 60, but you couldn't do 60 miles an hour. You have no car, before you're halfway down it.
John, thank you very much. Good morning to you. Good morning to you. Let's come back then to the story about the notes that Michelle Neal's department won't leave. We asked the DUP's Brian Kingston to comment about this. DUP didn't get back to us. Timothy Gaston from the TUV did. He was the man speaking in the committee meeting. And he's been telling us about how he feels about not being able to get these notes about what happened between Michelle O'Neill, the handwritten notes, which would summarise what happened between Michelle O'Neill and Paula Bradshaw.
Well, Stephen, on the back of the newsletter trying to obtain this information through FOI that has been denied by the private office, I thought it was the right forum yesterday to try and get the committee to put on some pressure that these handwritten notes would be released for people to see. Let's be very clear, on the back of the COVID inquiry, there's an expectation on civil servants taking the notes that they would be released at a future date. So any obstacles and the challenges I faced yesterday were certainly futile, and there's an expectation that any note that is taken at any of these meetings should be made public. Let's not forget, this was the chairperson of a committee who had went to have a private meeting with a witness. So if there's nothing to hide, there's no reason that these handwritten notes shouldn't be released for all to see. We have seen in previous times where there has been handwritten notes which give a fuller minute of the meeting rather than the typed up version that are released further down the line. So I'm very interested to see why these handwritten notes have been withheld, and I'll be doing all I can to ensure they're put into the public domain.
Paula Bradshaw, the chair, as you know, she's accusing you of consistently, constantly trying to disrupt her committee.
Well, that's very good for Paula to claim. Paula doesn't like hard questions. We've seen that in the last number of committees.
She's getting plenty of them, isn't she? And she's dealing with them, to be fair to her.
What's that, dealing with what, Stephen?
She's dealing with you and your questions and questions from many people around that committee. And she's not a witness. She's the chair.
She's not a witness, but the way she has handled and chaired the meeting, especially the one of the First Minister, has called into question how she handled some of the more tough exchanges, more robust exchanges. Look, we are there as a scrutiny committee. It's important that elected members, regardless of party, regardless of party size, are given the opportunity to scrutinise and ask robust questions of those coming to committee to give evidence.
Is your party going to submit an appeal or is that for Thompson at the newsletter to do? Who's going to question this with the Information Commissioner, or what are you going to do next?
Well, my hope that David from the newsletter, who has been very good in covering this story, who's been very proactive in covering this story, will submit the appeal himself. If he doesn't do that, well, then we'll have to explore other means, and I'll have to do that as an MLA. I don't want to have to do that as an MLA, but if I have to, I certainly will.
You were told in that committee it's not their job to help journalists, is it?
Stephen, let's put this...
Or to do the job of journalism.
This was a private meeting held between the chairperson and the witness, directly relating to an evidence session
that was taking place later on
at committee. So this relates to our committee. This relates to the integrity of our committee. This relates to how the committee session with the First Minister was handled. So this directly relates to our committee, and anybody else that seems to claim otherwise, as we heard yesterday, my proposal was bunkers, but I think those who are claiming otherwise are the ones that have questions to answer.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. That's Timothy Gaston on Notegate. James is in Lisburn on the unions threatening to strike. Patrick Mahon from NIPSA says they want to make the government squeal. Morning, James.
Morning, Stephen. You all right?
I'm doing all right today, thank you, yes.
I just think that the teachers, nurses, doctors should be really careful what they wish for. Because
all they're asking for is the same amount of money as across the water.
Yeah, but our cost of living compared to across the water is considerably lower. We don't pay for water. We don't pay income tax or council tax. We don't pay council tax. So it's going to get to the point where these people are asking for an extra 2% or an extra 3%. and everybody's going to have to suffer for it, and they're going to lose that 2 or 3% builds. Stormont are going to have to come to a decision someday whether we're going to have to start paying for water or income tax.
Well,
money has to come from somewhere, because it's going to be Rob and Peter to pay Paul. That's the way it works.
Have a listen, James, to some of what Patrick Mulholland, he's representing NPSA. NPSA is one of the biggest health union health unions. Have a listen to this, which Patrick Mulholland said this morning to me.
If we don't pay the workers, just think what's going to happen in A&Es. Just think what will happen in the ambulances. And just think what's going to happen in family and childcare services in Northern Ireland. Children are going to die unless somebody steps up and sorts this mess out.
So I actually nearly want to play that again. Is NPSA saying that if they don't get the pay award they want, children are going to die? Did I hear that right?
Well, you heard it, but that's a union holding the feet to the fire, trying to put people under pressure.
In what way are children going to die because of these strikes? What does he mean?
You'll have to ask him, but he's worried about his members, which is 100%.
But let me hear this again.
If we don't pay the workers, just think what's going to happen in A&Es. Just think what will happen in the ambulances. And just think what's going to happen in family and childcare services in Northern Ireland. Children are going to die unless somebody steps up and sorts this mess out.
So what are they going? What's their strike action going to do to children's services?
Obviously, he's going to say that children's services will not be able to be manned because they're going to go out on strike. And I don't know. Maybe that's what he's implying. But I think he has to take it from a government. He's obviously from a union side, but he needs to look at it from the government side. And I'm not a fan of the government, but everything, you can't magic money out of the sky.
James, thank you. Thank you for your call this morning. One last call on the potholes this time, Frank in Belfast. We've got 1.5 minutes, Frank. Shoot.
Okay, Stephen, it's not only about potholes in the country, it's potholes in the town. There's too much traffic on the roads. And I would say that the one they abandoned non-essential traffic two days a week. And midweek
days,
not Saturdays or Sundays.
What do you mean abandon it?
We have and what they should do is buses. There's plenty of buses on in
are
the
there?
City.
Have you seen
and
plenty
they can
of the,
get on the buses?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Have you seen plenty of the cancellations of the buses? Oh, just a wee note out from Translink. Sorry, our service isn't running on time today. Or walk
yes,
from here to there. Oh, we're not picking you up at the bus stop as scheduled
Stephen,
today. Move to another one. And you've got to walk.
We know what they've done. We know what they've done. The stupidity of them taking away the Boyne Bridge, for example. And now they learn the good subsequent quality of traffic that we wanted. They were a failure, an immense failure. But I still say, let only essential traffickers, like district nurses, like doctors, you
keep
know,
us all
even
off the
taxis,
roads.
Give the taxis a bit of money,
make
too.
Fat people like me walk. Thank you, Frank. That's it for today. We'll see you tomorrow when we start at 9 o'clock. Enjoyed your company today. See you in the morning. Bye-bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.